hello, and joining you this week from the Casco Viejo in Bilbao, where I arrived yesterday under the misapprehension that the Grand Départ must already be happening, having heard the immortal words, "The tour is the tour," from riders in at least three separate interviews over the last week. My name's Daniel Freeber. I'm the host of this week's episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we'll mainly be discussing whether there are indeed more stupid things than looking into a camera and telling the world your name is Primoz Roglic. Why, contrary to what Thibaut Pinot says, we'd all take popularity over success, and David Gourdou's ideas on elevator etiquette. In fact, we won't be talking about any of that, full disclosure. But we will be talking about what everyone has been talking about over the last few days, namely Tour de France Unchained, i.e. Netflix blockbuster new documentary series. Helping us to do that will be one of the men behind the project, executive producer James Gay Rees. But before we get to him, I should also introduce the other man most commonly responsible for the Unchained melody that is this podcast, which is not to say that we are brothers or particularly righteous. Lonely rivers flow to the sea, to the sea. He is the Lion of Not Watford, Lionel Burney.
Wow.
How are you, Lionel?
Wow, I'm very well. I'm very well, Daniel. And I'm staggered to learn that you're already in Bilbao. You do realise that you basically got two and a half weeks of rest days before the race actually starts. So I'm expecting you to be on peak form for your television this summer.
I'm trying to soak up some atmosphere, Lionel. I'll be out there tomorrow in the Calais, in fact, they call them, of Bilbao, just recording birdsong and the noise of passers-by.
Oh, this sounds fantastic. If you could record some of that for our Basque Country Kilometre Zero episode.
I will be. That would be great.
Yeah, wonderful.
Anyway, how are you, Lionel?
I'm very well, thank you, Daniel. Yes, the Tour de France is approaching very quickly. I'm having a few rest days of my own too, just before we all set off for the Grand Départ over there in northern Spain. So, quite energized and enthused, having binged the Netflix.
That'll soon end.
No, you're going to have to take my word for it. Having binged Unchained on Netflix, and it really got me in the Tour de France mood, brought me bang up to speed, reminded me of some of the key storylines from last year's race, and it sort of whetted the appetite. And to be fair, kind of overshadowed the Dauphiné for me, really. I was more compelled by last year's action than this year's because, well, as we'll probably hear in your news roundup, the direction of travel from the Dauphiné was, well, it was one-way traffic for a former fish market worker from Denmark, wasn't it?
I was in the Ribera, the very famous covered market in Bilbao earlier today. Lots of fishmongers in there. Made me think of Jonas Vingegaard. Lionel, just on Tour de France fever, I can tell you that, well, to the extent to which the airport is decked out in Tour de France bunting and decoration is always a bit of an indication of how excited people are. There is a bit of it in the airport. There was a bit of it yesterday. I also saw there's an official Tour de France merchandise stand that I passed yesterday, not far from the Guggenheim Museum. My taxi driver was talking about the Tour de France yesterday. That's always a good sign as well. He certainly knew that it's coming down. And yesterday, I went for dinner in a burger joint, effectively, a posh hipster burger joint. They also had vegan, vegetarian burgers, but they most significantly had a burger called the Tony Rominger. And I asked why this was, and it was apparently just because the owner of the burger joint is a fanatical cycling fan. So who knows, tomorrow I might go and catch up with him, see just how fanatical he is. No other cyclists on the menu, no burgers named after any other cyclist. So we're very curious about why he chose Tony Rominger, which also spelt wrong on the menu. It was the Tomy, like Tomy Toys Rominger.
Well, won the Welter, of course, didn't he, Rominger? World hour record.
Probably won the Tour of the Basque Country, did he? Probably.
Well, certainly world hour record holder at one point, wasn't he? Maybe. Was it not some kind of eating challenge? You have to finish the burger. Was it huge and you have to finish it in under an hour?
I don't think so. Anyway, Lionel, shall we get on with the news roundup featuring the Dauphiné that bored you and maybe some other people? Or didn't excite you to the extent that the Tour de France is going to excite you. And Tony Rominger didn't win the Tour of the Basque Country, by the way. I'm just checking. So, news roundup. It was the Dauphiné. It finished at the weekend with an emphatic victory for Jonas Vingegaard. 2 minutes and 23 seconds his cushion over Adam Yates of UAE. He was second, and 2 minutes 56 seconds over Ben O'Connor. He was third. Final stage was won by Giulio Ciccone, who incidentally today revealed why he sort of signaled the number 27 with his fingers as he came over the line on Sunday, 2027 being the year until which he has extended his contract with what will imminently become Lidl Trek. So he won on the Bastille on Sunday. The further stage wins for Vingegaard twice, in fact. Georg Zimmermann of Intermarché, Mikael Bjerg won the time trial, Christophe Laporte won two stages, and Julien Alaphilippe. We should just dwell for a second on the Dauphiné, Lionel. More than a second, Vingegaard. That was a shot across everyone's bows, wasn't it? Tadej Pogacar's bows. I did lots of interviews with people last week in which they talked about the gulf between Vingegaard and the rest of the assembled GC aspirants for the Tour de France. A very amusing one with Esteban Chavez, where he enacted a hierarchy with his hands, and he sort of said that, this doesn't work very well on podcasts, actually. He sort of said that we're down here. There are a few riders who are here, just a centimeter or two above where he put his hand. And then he sort of reached to the sky and he said, this is where Vingegaard is right now. And then let out a big sort of belly laugh. Esteban Chavez in EF Education First, incidentally, had a shocker on Sunday. Did you see that Carapaz was almost last on Sunday's stage, which was slightly alarming. But your thoughts on where the wind is currently blowing, where the weather vane, this famous Vingegaard Pogacar weather vane, is currently pointing?
Well, it has to be pointing to Vingegaard now, doesn't it? I mean, Pogacar, we'll get an idea. I mean, what sort of idea will we get of the form he's in from a ride at the national championships in Slovenia? We'll get something. Presumably, it will be a boost to at least have a race day before the Tour de France. But Vingegaard has not really put a foot wrong, has he? And in the Dauphiné, it was the time gaps. It was the fact that he was clearly the best on all of the mountain stages. You know, he did a good time trial as well. And not that, you know, time trialing is going to be key to the Tour de France, because there's very little time trialing, but it is an indicator of form, isn't it? It means that his legs are going round quickly and he's strong. And there's no real sense that there's a sort of chink in the armour at the moment. But, you know, 2 weeks to go until everyone will arrive in Bilbao, and it's a long way between now and the sort of business end of the Tour de France. So I think, you know, recent years we've seen riders win the Dauphiné and then be very good at the Tour de France. I have no reason to suspect this won't be the case for him, but that doesn't mean he'll have everything all his own way. I suppose looking at the GC from the Dauphiné, the rest of the riders all sort of look like, you know, sort of sixth place type riders for the Tour de France, didn't they? They'll probably be too unhappy with where they're standing. But as Chavez said to you, the problem is that is quite a long way away from where Vingegaard and where we have to assume Pogacar will reach as well. So
there was a sort of second tier of riders who all were satisfied with their Dauphiné. So Ben O'Connor, Jai Hindley, and Jack Haig. In fact, Jack Haig, who did the Giro d'Italia, did the Dauphiné, got that sort of custard pie of being sent to the Dauphiné, but then also by the end of the week was talking quite bullishly about maybe doing the Tour de France. Quite enthusiastic at that idea. But then there was another layer of riders, or another tier of riders, who really had pretty disastrous Dauphinés. David Gourdou being one. Carapaz in the end being another, certainly as far as general classification was concerned. And there were a couple of others as well. Henrik Maas didn't have a particularly good week. Mikel Landa as well. I should also mention, we should also just pick out Max Poole's performance. DSM, 20 years old, already fourth in Tour de Romandie earlier this year. From Scunthorpe, the son of a window cleaner, Lionel. I suspect that this is going to be the line that's trotted out about him. for the foreseeable future, until he replaces that narrative with something a little bit more nuanced, a little bit less caricatured. But what a talent he is, and what a performance. He lost the white jersey on the last day to Carlos Rodriguez. Of course, won't be going to the Tour de France, but definitely one of the stars, one of the revelations of the week. Lionel, remaining in France, on Tuesday we had the CIC Mont Ventoux race, which was shortened due to an inclement weather forecast. Hence, the race lost one ascent of the Giant of Provence, but may have seen the birth of a star with the 19-year-old Lenny Martinez of Groupama FDJ outsprinting Mike Woods to take victory. Martinez split time between Chalet Reynal and the summit of Mont Ventoux was, so social media said, the fastest ever recorded, including, you know, the likes of Chris Froome, Marco Pantani, the controversial Lance Armstrong, and so on and so forth. So, a joyous conclusion to that race and a very regrettable, controversial one for another mountainous race sponsored by the same company, CIC, at the weekend, the Women's Tour Féminin International des Pyrénées. That race was cut short, declared null and void. I think it's been declared null and void, Lionel. Do you know, do the previous two stage results, do they count towards rankings?
Oh, that is a good question. Whether they will count towards rankings, I have to be honest, I don't actually know. I was away over the weekend, so kind of just caught the controversy, and obviously saw the fallout, saw the reaction from Adam Hansen and the others at the CPA, the union for riders, and the extraordinary reaction from the race organizer, who really didn't judge the temperature of the water terribly well, did he? I mean,
Pascal Baudron, what's happening is that the girls have demands that don't match their level. He said, quite honestly, I don't think it's worth organizing a race to see all those months of effort ruined for the whims of spoiled children, referring to the fact that, well, the UCI were the ones who had called the race off. After vehicles that didn't belong to the race convoy, they found their way onto the course on both stages one and two, didn't they?
Well, it wasn't just that, was it? It was also parked vans. It was, there were numerous incidents. It was effectively like racing on open roads at times by the looks of the footage I saw. But yeah, not the response that a responsible race organizer should really make. Yeah, hold hands up, apologize, and vow to do better, I think, is probably the only response. And well, if he feels it's not worth the effort, he may well have that decision taken out of his hands anyway. So yeah, not great. I mean, Not much more to say about that, really, other than that the athletes deserve a lot better.
Staying put for one last piece of French news, Groupama FDJ boss Marc Madiot has delighted many, and in the rider's own words, sickened Arnaud Démare by confirming that Thibaut Pinot will go to the Tour de France and Démare will not. Démare told L'Equipe that Madiot informed him at the Boucle de la Moyenne at the end of May that he would not be renewing Démare's contract. Nonetheless, Démare said his selection for the Tour team had been a done deal since the winter, at least as far as he was concerned, only for Madiot to call and tell him otherwise last Thursday. This is a risky move, I think, Lionel, by Madiot, particularly in light of Gourdou's performance in the Dauphiné, and also the fact there's no time trial that's obviously going to suit Stefan Kung in the Tour de France. Not all eggs in the Pinot basket. I think Thibaut Pinot does have some chickens, actually. But the eggs will be shared between him and David Gourdou, and they're very much on the mountainous stages, aren't they?
They are. I mean, the difficulty of the route is there aren't a huge number of opportunities for the sprinters. But Démare, you know, on his day and in good form, he is resilient, isn't he? And you would have thought would give them an opportunity for a stage win. It's tricky, that, isn't it? Because presumably this means that they're going to go for GC with a rider who currently 2.5 weeks away, Gourdou I'm talking about, is bang out of form. And Pinot will be riding his final Tour. That will obviously garner a lot of publicity for the team, Groupama FDJ. But In terms of kind of getting a result, it does pile an awful lot of pressure onto a rider who isn't going into the Tour as well as he would want to.
Yeah, what we don't really know is how much Dimal's relationship with Gourdeau has played a role here. I mentioned Gourdeau's elevator etiquette in the introduction. That refers to a scene in Netflix where he basically kicks the Netflix crew out of an elevator. But there was also this story, wasn't there? David Gourdeau, he had been fairly indiscreet about his relationship with Arnaud Démare on Twitch, wasn't it? Was it on Discord? On Discord. And he also mentioned the fact that Démare were not wanting to get into a lift with him at the team training camp. Well, he'd alleged this, but we know that they don't particularly get on. There was a bit of a rapprochement or an attempt to bring them together at Paris-Nice. Démare actually worked pretty well for David Gourdeau at Paris-Nice, and it seemed like that hatchet had been buried and that they would be able to work harmoniously at the Tour de France. But of course, Pino had a good Giro d'Italia, and I think that has, well, that made Maddio probably reconsider the balance of the team, and Pino is now going for his last hurrah. Démare is not. Another couple of bits of racing to cover. The Tour de Suisse got underway on Sunday with Stefan Kung, the aforementioned Stefan Kung, taking the first leader's jersey after a 12.7-kilometre time trial in Einsiedeln. Since then, stage wins have gone to Binyam Girmay, Matthias Schellmoser, and Felix Gall, AG2R's Austrian climber, who at the time of recording with the Queen Stage to La Punt come on Friday, also leads the GC by 2 seconds from Schellmoser and 16 from Remco Evenepoel. Also, two other national tours of Belgium and Slovenia got underway on Wednesday. Jasper Philipsen took stage one in Belgium, and Dylan Groenewegen got off to a flying start in Slovenia. That's about it for the week's newsline. I was going to mention Silvio Berlusconi, the death, obviously, of Silvio Berlusconi, huge news in Italy. He has had some cycling links, was the secondary sponsor to the Amore Vita team in 1997-98 with Forza Arcore, and from 1993 to 1997 his Mediaset television empire with their first channel Italia Uno. They were broadcasters of the Giro d'Italia, and that was quite controversial, caused a little debate at the time, because it was the first time that Giro d'Italia had been taken off state television. Silvio Berlusconi, who of course died earlier this week.
Well, Daniel, I haven't had my eyes across all of the racing over the last few days, mainly because I've been away for a few days. I'll talk about that in a moment. But one of the things that really struck me, looking at all of the results and seeing the performances in the Dauphiné and who's going well in the other stage races, is all the names that we expect to see doing things at the Tour de France, contesting for stage wins or the GC, are all kind of coming to the fore now, aren't we? It's quite an exciting time of the season, this, when we realise that the Tour de France is almost upon us. Now, as I say, I was away over the weekend because I was up in Edinburgh in Scotland for a memorial event for our dear friend Richard Moore, who died in March last year. And it was a lovely day on Saturday. There was a bike ride in the morning, several laps of Holyrood Park with great views of Arthur's Seat and the city as we went round. The ride was led by Richard's dad, Brian Moore, and there was a great turnout, including Sir Chris Hoy, Olympic champion, multiple Olympic champion, who was a very good friend of Richard's, of course. And then in the afternoon, there was an event held at Summer Hall, a huge gathering of Richard's friends and family, including a number of colleagues from the press room as well. And I was really honoured to be asked to speak as Richard's friend, but also on behalf of the podcast. And it was especially proud to see the podcast so well represented at the event. Orla Chenoui hosted proceedings absolutely brilliantly. Her cycling podcast Feminine co-host Rose Manley was there as well. And all of our producers made the trip as well. Adam, Will, Hugh and Tom were also there, as was David Luxton and our old friend Jonathan Rowe, who left the podcast a couple of years ago. And incredibly, Stacey Snyder came all the way over from the US. And it was great to have so many people who have been part of the team that Richard helped build over the years, all there in the same room to remember Richard. And the day before the memorial, we all made a trip, or some of us made a trip, to Linlithgow, which is to the west of Edinburgh, to the West Lothian Cycle Circuit. The circuit opened at the end of last month after years of planning and fundraising. It's about a 1 kilometre long circuit, and it's for riders to race on, train on, hopefully spot and develop the future World Tour riders from Scotland. We were shown around by former Scotland Commonwealth Games rider James McCullum, who was also a friend of Richard's, and we all rode a lap of the circuit, including the little cobbled section that they've managed to put in as well. Fantastic facility. Great to see it actually existing, because when Simon Gill and I were there back in April last year, it was still at the planning stage, really. They hadn't really started work on actually getting the circuit down. And of course, you may remember back in 2019, when we first started selling Stacey Snyder's Cycling Podcast mugs, a portion of the proceeds would go to a good cause each time. And one of the first causes to receive some money was the West Lothian Cycle Circuit. And Matt Ball, one of the driving forces behind the circuit, wanted to thank Stacey, all of the Cycling Podcast listeners, and above all, Richard, for their support in helping to make the circuit a reality. And to the extent that they're going to name one of the corners after Richard, the top corner, the big hairpin just before the finish line, will be called Buffalo Bend. And Stacey's in the process of making a ceramic plaque that will be bronzed and placed on the grass bank overlooking that corner. A really lovely way for them to remember and honour Richard's legacy, not just as somebody who helped out in a small way with the circuit becoming a reality, but because really cycling was Richard's life. And he, well, it's easy for me to forget sometimes that he was very good at it too, wasn't he? Because we pulled each other's legs over the years recording the podcast. You know, he wore his knowledge quite lightly at times, didn't he? And easy to forget that he was a Scottish national junior champion, and he represented his country at a major games, the Commonwealth Games in 1998, and he was very proud to do that. So I know, Daniel, you were at the Dauphiné, one of a large number of people who weren't able to make it because of clashes, but you were there in spirit, and I mentioned you in my speech as being the third leg of our cycling podcast bar stool, and hopefully there'll be some other events to honour and remember Richard over the coming years. But it was a fantastic day, and it was a real privilege to be able to be there and remember Richard.
Well, Lionel, now to the main event of this week's podcast. I said in the intro that we'd be talking about Tour de France Unchained, Netflix 8-part series about the 2022 Tour de France. I don't think it needs too much introduction. It's been the talk of professional cycling for many months now, hasn't it? And well, we were very fortunate earlier in the week to be joined by James Gay Rees, who's a very acclaimed film producer. He's one of the individuals behind this series with his company Box to Box. He's multi-award winning film producer, won BAFTA for Senna in 2010, one of his best, or certainly one of his best known works, Senna, documentary about the tragically deceased Brazilian motor racing driver, Formula One pilot Ayrton Senna. He also won an Oscar for Amy, a documentary about Amy Winehouse in 2015. His company is also behind Drive to Survive, the series really that spawned Tour de France Unchained. Gives Formula One motor racing the same treatment that he's now given Tour de France. Also, Full Swing about PGA Tour and golf, and Breakpoint about professional tennis as well. And Lionel, well, we personally have enjoyed many of his films, haven't we? I mean, Senna goes without saying, Amy as well. Maradona is another absolute classic, another one of his collaborations with Asif Kapadia, who he's done a lot of films with. Also, some of the ones that people may be less familiar with, I've mentioned on the podcast before, All This Mayhem about the Pappas brothers, who caused a sensation in skateboarding, and several others that you've seen as well.
Well, the one that stands out for me is the Maradona film, which really kind of ripped up what a sports film could be, because it really zoomed in on a particular period in Maradona's life, and perhaps not a period that many people are that familiar with. And well, the opening sequence of the film has lived with me because it was such an unusual way to start a sports film. It really homed in on the the person and the profile of Maradona, who obviously, as you experienced during the Giro, is, well, he's an almost godlike figure in Napoli, isn't he? And so, yeah, with that and with Drive to Survive, which I'll be totally honest, I am not into Formula One at all. It hasn't converted me to Formula One either, but I did find particularly the first couple of series of that very watchable because it humanized the drivers underneath the helmets. And it really kind of played up the, you know, the drama of the events. It kind of slowed down an extremely fast sport, didn't it? That was what it did. It kind of put some, you know, a human face on the front of those helmets and gave a bit of an insight into what it takes to drive a car that fast. So I had, yeah, high expectations for the Unchained series and was really interested to see how it would turn out and very interested to speak to the man himself about what he made of the experience.
Well, Lionel, without further ado, here we are in conversation with James Gate Rees on Wednesday morning.
Vous êtes des soldats, vous êtes des guerriers, vous accrochez le dossard, vous devenez un autre homme.
Le Tour de France, c'est très simple. Ça brûle. On est essoufflé.
Speed is relentless.
Just be ready for anything.
C'est la course la plus dure au monde.
La douleur permet de savoir qui on est.
Oh, on va la gagner, cette putain d'étape!
Jumbo Visma in absolute chaos.
C'est une course à élimination. Il va falloir faire des choses qui presque sortent de l'ordinaire.
Quand on fait le Tour de France, on rentre dans un truc spécial.
Well, James, first of all, it's a great privilege to meet you and to have you here with us today. And I guess, I imagine you're probably glorying in some of the sparkling reviews that you've already had in the first week, or not even a week yet since the series has been released. I mean, how is this period for you generally?
It's always really good fun. I mean, listen, the reviews seem to be really good here and in France. So, you know, it's a nice moment. I mean, we find out from Netflix a bit later how the show is doing sort of around the world. So hopefully that's positive. But it feels like the word of mouth is really strong. And yeah, it's just that question of just getting it out there to as many people as possible. But no, it's really interesting. I think the show is going down with people. I think it's connecting with people. I think you don't have to be a mad cycling fan to enjoy the show at all, actually, because I'm not. And I, you know, really enjoyed the discovery process of making the show, you know. So hopefully it'll find a new audience, which will elevate all things tour.
You're not a mad cycling fan, you said there, but I understand you sort of on the way to becoming one, or were in the process of making this film. Is that right?
No, I sort of like pointedly stayed out of the madness and the build up to the show because there were a lot of people on the production that were pretty hardcore cyclists. And I thought, a lot of people who weren't, but I sort of made sure that I stayed relatively kind of like uninvested until the edit so that I could basically approach the edit with the team with a real sort of like punter's point of view to make sure that I understood what was going on. And I think historically, I think I've been a bit scared of the tour. I think I've always found it a little bit intimidating. In the sense, did I understand it? What was it all about? You know, was it for me? Because I'm a massive sports fan and I kind of like, I didn't have a huge amount of bandwidth left in order to kind of like dive into the tour. But I was really glad that ultimately I did maintain that perspective because when it came to the edit and trying to work out what it was all about, listen, I'm not now the world's greatest cycling expert, but I did learn enough to understand what the key fundamentals were and to appreciate it just for what it was. I now think it's amazing. I'm just completely enthralled to it and can't wait to sort of dive into it and really kind of pretend to be an aficionado when I'm not.
This year. James, we'll get into the weeds a little bit of, well, the filmmaking process and also, well, your burgeoning interest in a minute. But Lionel and I were curious. Well, we'd like to explain, because there's a lot of sort of speculation on social media about who had what influence in this. Could you just explain this sort of 4 points or this quadrangle of box to box, quad box, ASO, effectively the organizer of the Tour de France, and Netflix? So how the series came about involving those sort of 4 points of that square?
I mean, really, basically, Quadbox is a joint venture between our company, Box to Box, and Quad in Paris. Okay. And we were sort of introduced to each other by Netflix to become sort of friends and buddies in order to make this show and another show for them. And it's been a very happy union, actually. We're long-term partners now, and we intend to carry on working together on as many things as possible. There's nothing really sort of that magical about it. We were brought together by Netflix. I think Netflix, Quad, and ASO were probably talking already. And they brought us into the mix because we make Drive to Survive in these other shows. So, you know, there's this kind of suspicion that we know what we're doing, which we don't really, obviously. So they brought us in, and we tried to muck it up, and we didn't fail. So, you know, that was really it.
Yeah, the other quadrangle is the three series that precede this: Drive to Survive, Breakpoint, Full Swing, and now Unchained, of course. I mean, how does cycling compare to those other sports? I mean, I can think of some obvious differences. There's a lot more athletes involved for a start. So it must have been harder to sort of identify the leading characters that you wanted to focus on. But in pure mechanics, how did it compare trying to shoot the Tour de France compared to a season of Formula One or the tennis tour or the golf tour?
Well, it's a lot shorter, isn't it? For a start, the set pieces are a lot shorter. So, you know, you've only got a couple of weeks to really nail it, 3 weeks to really get inside the tour and try to work out what's going on. So, you know, try and survive 9 or 10 month season. So if you don't get Ferrari relatively early in the year, you try and get them later in the season. So there's that difference. And that applies to golf and tennis as well, because they're all long seasons. So the shape of the series is very different. The thing that probably is most equivalent to it is the Six Nations, which we've just done a show about, which again was obviously sort of like a 2 month period. So it's slightly shorter as well. And therefore you don't really get that many opportunities to catch up. You've got to hit it pretty much first time in some capacity. And I think that's definitely a challenge with the tour, and obviously it keeps on moving. It's not stationary. It's a completely fluid thing. So in all these shows, you basically have to put bets on where you think the action's going to be at some point. I think it's maybe slightly easier to work out which stages are going to be more meaningful to which teams. But I mean, listen, as a novice, you know, I can't pretend to somebody sort of tell you exactly which team and where, but I think that would be the fundamental difference, is the length of the, you know, is shorter, and therefore you've got to just be filming all the time with as many teams as you possibly can and hope that you're in the right place at the right time. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. Mm-hmm.
I mean, James, I think probably when you talk to people or they talk to you about Drive to Survive, what a lot of people will talk about is the characters and their, you know, the fondness that's grown for certain characters, people like Toto Wolff and Günther Steiner over the course of a 3 or 4 series, really. How much did you think that this was going to be character-driven in the same way, and how much preparatory work went into identifying who those, call it, eccentric characters? Or, you know, I mean, Lionel and I, we make documentary podcasts, and we find ourselves over the course of time, we gravitate obviously towards, even, you know, to really get granular about it, to people with better voices, to people who, you know, have strange quirks. How much preparatory work went into, like, before your crews arrived at the Tour de France, into identifying who they were?
Well, I didn't do that work, to be honest with you. So a lot of work went into that, to be honest with you, in terms of building those relationships, but I didn't truthfully do any of that. It was the kind of wider team. And so, like I said, they put a bunch of, you know, you can't make a documentary about a bunch of people who don't want you to make a documentary about them. So you've got to basically be pushing on an open door. And so, as you know, you guys probably know. And so we basically went to where the access was basically willing. And you know, obviously each team's got their own narrative, and you know, if you compare Jumbo Visma to EF, they're very different kind of like narratives, right? So you want to blend the different sort of characters to sustain the series. And I think we had that in the main. I think we did get a good sort of cast of willing contributors, and access is always an ongoing challenge with anybody in any show. You know, who in their right mind really wants to invite a camera into their lives for, you know, 3 weeks or for 10 months? You know what I mean? It's like, I probably wouldn't be first in the queue, to be honest with you. Not that it'd make a very interesting documentary, but I think it finds its own level, you know. You put a lot of flies in the water, and, you know, people step up. Some people take the fly, some people don't. Some people swim around the fly for ages, you know, and you eventually just get to where you get to, and you can't force anybody to do anything they don't want to do. And people have to meet you halfway in the process. And sometimes that's enough, and sometimes it's not quite enough, you know. So you just kind of, you just keep diplomatically trying to massage the situation and to get people to buy in as much as possible. But it is what it is. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the process. How many people are actually on the ground in the crews, you know, across all of the different teams that you were filming?
Again, it's not really my department, but I mean, you know, there were basically, I think there were 8 PDs monitoring 8 different teams most of the time, and they would be backed up by sound and data and production. So, God knows. I mean, honestly, I couldn't tell you how many people are on the ground, but you know, it can't be anything less than 50, I would guess. But you know, then there's a whole ton of people back in the UK or back in France. So, yeah, that would be my very uneducated guess. Would be 50.
So what was the first point of your involvement? So the crews all go out. What were you doing when the Tour de France started this time last year?
Probably making another show at some point. So I sort of didn't get involved until the edit, truthfully. So obviously I was aware that it was happening. I was in various meetings of Netflix. My partner Paul did the heavy lifting with ASA for sure. And with Jan at Quad, did the, you know, was Jan and Paul really got it over the line. And like all the things, you know, there's multiple conversations and, you know, kind of takes a while to for everything to fall into place. And then Jan was very much on the ground during the tour. Paul was in and out. And I was certainly doing something else at the time because we have a sort of variety of shows going on. And then I determined to stay out of the process until quite late on because I thought that somebody had to basically watch the thing as a real novice to see what it, you know, what we had and whether it made any sense to anybody and try to work out what the point of it was, you know. So and I really enjoyed that, actually. I was really glad that I had that kind of complete impartiality and ignorance about it, to be honest with you, because it allowed me to kind of like try to put it all together.
So what were you looking for when you first sat down to watch what had been brought back and put together? What were you looking for?
Just the same with always, it's like something that people are going to give a shit about. You know, why will anybody watch this show? If you don't know anything about it at all, why would you get involved? You know, why would you stay with it? And you have to try and work out what the really fundamental, you know, emotional gears are of the show. We've all ridden a bike, right? So it's like, it's relatable on some level, but then you realize pretty quickly that it's totally unrelatable in the main because it's so mad, so dangerous, so clever, so strategic and so compelling. But actually, you've got to kind of go quite a long way to mess it up, really. So it was just about trying to make it that relatable, you know, relatable as much as possible. And I think luckily the team did a great job of getting a lot of the good stories in the event. I think there are plenty of moments in the series where you just kind of go, I just can't believe what I'm seeing. It's just like, it's so out of control that these people actually do this with their lives. It's a bit like tennis in a way, you know, we can all play tennis, but not many people can really deal with the pressure of being in a Grand Slam situation. And like, I think we can all ride a bike, but I'm not sure many people can go over the Pyrenees in a hurry. So that was what really blew my mind, was the sheer extremity of what they do. And also the kind of strategy and the kind of like the massive game of chess that it is, you know, I found fascinating. And by the way, you know, I'm looking at it from a pretty binary, you know, novice entry level. So I'm hoping to build on my knowledge.
I mean, James, you guys, you know, the sort of victims of your own success with Drive to Survive. You've done such a fantastic job with that, well, you have now had propositions to treat other sports. But I'm just wondering, you take a film like the Maradona film that you did with Asif Kapadia, and Lionel and I mean, we both watched that and we both love it. And the thing we both sort of admire about that, and this applies to the stuff we do as well when we're writing features, is the bravery to look through a microscope rather than a telescope. And the fact that with that film, you know, it wasn't a film about Maradona's whole life. You maybe understood Maradona's whole life through the prism of the that concentrated period of 3 or 4 years in Naples. And that was a very brave choice, but, emphatically worked. These series, by their very nature, are sprawling. You're being asked, you're being called upon to introduce a lot of characters, a lot of different narratives, and somehow weave them together. How challenging is that for a documentary maker?
They're totally different processes because, one's archive, right? And one's access. So they're totally different processes. You do a different part of your brain. And at the end of the day, story is story and themes are themes and all that jazz. But archive is, even that movie, for example, probably we would have had, 3,000 hours of archive, I'm guessing, to make a nice movie. And, Senna, we could have carried on archiving forever, I think. We just had to stop and kind of make...
I think you said you had 5,000 hours 5,000 hours concentrated into two. Yeah.
So it's like it's... and this is totally different. I mean, there's a very high ratio of what you shoot to what you end up using in an episode. But access is totally different because, you're on the ground in the moment trying to sort of like capture things that matter. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. But with archive, you can have so much of it that you can sort of holistically bend it to your will in order to make a point. And I think it's it is literally entirely different. I think that obviously the Maradona film was about somebody's, 10 years of somebody's life, whatever it was, right? About 3 weeks. So they really are totally different beasts. And there's no real, they're both documentaries, apparently, but that's where it kind of ends. You know what I mean? They're different exercises. And one's about the moment, one's about, well, they're both about the moment, but they're very sort of different definitions of the moment. So it's they're weird bedfellows. They don't really, apart from the fact they're kind of both loosely documentary, they're not, the process is so radically different. And 10 episodes is a massive challenge to get over the line because it's all going to feel like part of the same series, which is difficult sometimes.
Yeah, 8 episodes is not very much. I mean, as we talked about in professional cycling, there might be 220 people you could potentially focus on, whereas in it's self-selected in Formula One, there are 20 drivers and 10 team principals. Is that a hugely challenging aspect of this particular proposition, the Tour de France proposition as well? Just how to wrap your arms around some or all of it?
You can't film everybody. You can't film everybody all the time because that would be a sort of like an insane exercise. So you have to, like I said, you've got to play some bets and you've got to basically back some teams and see how they get on. And, you can sort of make, anybody's got a story, right? Not everybody has to be, having a complete epiphany or revelation or kind of like, conversion all the time. Everybody's journey from when they wake up in the morning to the end of the day is a narrative. So it's just the context and how it all fits together. So, you choose the teams that are basically are open to the process and then you see where it goes. I mean, there's no mad science to it. There were certain teams we filmed that didn't do much. So therefore you're like, okay, well, and that happens in Formula One all the time. There are certain teams that, basically they start the season in ninth and they finish the season in ninth. And you're like, okay, well, that's kind of, it's maybe not as compelling as some other narratives. That's just the way the cookie crumbles a little bit.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. They've been backing us since 2016, and it's a relationship that started largely thanks to Stephen Moon, the CEO of Science in Sport. And it's one that we are very grateful for, not least because I get the occasional energy gel to help me with my riding. Stephen Moon also started a relationship with the Tour de l'Unsar. When he heard about the event, he wanted to reach out and offer some support. And that has formalized into formal sponsorship of the Tour de l'Unsar, which is a grassroots stage race, which also has races for junior riders and women riders. It's in and around Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone. And if you listen to the latest episode of Service Course, there's an absolutely fantastic documentary piece put together by our producer, presenter extraordinaire, Tom Wally, and featuring friend of the podcast, Oscar Skarsbrough. Brooke, and it's a real immersive piece that takes you to Sierra Leone, to the area in and around Freetown, the capital where the race is held, and gives a real insight into what it's like just to get on a bike, let alone compete in that part of West Africa. And it's a real passion project for Stephen, because his belief is that cycling is for everybody. And well, his line was that if they can fuel riders who are taking part in Grand Fondos or charging around the Surrey Hills, well, they really ought to reach out and include all cyclists all over the world. And so that's how the relationship with the race began. And it's a fascinating event, and the piece is really worth listening out for. It's in service course. The latest episode is called From Lunsar to Arkansas, and it's on our feed now. If you want to find out more about Science in Sport, go to scienceinsport.com.
Tour de France is something you dream of when you're a little kid.
To go to Tour de France is always pressure. That's not easy.
If you win a stage here, it's probably one of the biggest things you can win in your whole career.
My mind is exploding. I never expected.
Vous accrochez le glossaire, vous devenez un autre homme.
Allez, 300 mètres, Bob, 300 mètres.
In the end, my only goal is to win.
Quand les années, ça se passe pas comme prévu, c'est difficile à vivre, hein.
The Tour de France is a completely linear event. Well, as all events are, it starts at the beginning and it ends at the end. And the series starts with the opening time trial in Copenhagen, and it finishes on the Champs-Élysées in Paris. But it kind of messes with my perception of what last year's Tour de France was, because it jumps about all over the place. I mean, how important was that to the storytelling, really? Because it does lift you up above this event led to that event led to this event style of narrative, and it did help elevate the characters, I felt, and meant that you could get a little bit more granular, despite this kind of challenges Daniel alluded to earlier, and focus, elevate certain people in certain episodes. I guess that was your job, to make the shape of the series come out the way that it did.
Yeah, it's always a kind of conversation with Netflix, because they're not that worried about chronology in anything, to be honest with you. They just want the series to be as strong as possible, obviously, and they want as many people to watch it as possible, and they want people to continue to watch the whole thing. So they tend to suggest that we kind of front-load the episodes with the strongest narratives, right? So there aren't that many things that have to be chronologically told, truthfully, at the end of the day. The Formula One season goes back and forth all the time, you know, and it's like the concept of the Six Nations. It's a league, so at the end of the day, doesn't really matter where you begin and end, because it's just at a league and somebody, you know, it's not like a knockout competition. This is like different, obviously, because it's a race, you know, with kind of, you know, with chronological stages, and it kind of, it's a different system. But, you know, as you can probably tell from the series, we didn't get too bogged down in the detail of, you know, who did what when, because it's not a highlight show, so it doesn't have to be that that faithful to the kind of truth. And if you were, probably, you know, it probably wouldn't really warrant the exercise, because people already, you know, a lot of people have already seen the actual tour on TV. So what's the point of basically telling what they already know? So you're trying to look at it from a different point of view and through a different lens for a reason. And sometimes you get it right and sometimes you don't, you know. So it's there's no hard and fast imperative or instruction about how to sequence it, but I think it sort of does end up with sort of some sort of common sense about the shape of things, and which characters when, and which stories when. And it's just sort of, it finds it its own level. And, you know, I hope that we get it right in the sequence, but ultimately that's for the audience to kind of, you know, agree or not.
I mean, I guess, James, it's sort of the story of your life as a documentary maker, that, or the treading the fine line between storytelling and, what, journalism, I suppose. You mentioned there, you know, it needs to correspond to the truth to a certain degree, but that's another question as well that people have asked over the last few days. There's been a bit of, well, there was a very, very light pushback, Wout van Aert sort of suggesting there was too much editorialization, or it was misleading the storyline in the first episode, having not seen the rest of the series, I don't think. But where if we were to sort of imagine a set of scales, how do you see your responsibility to the truth versus your responsibility to creating a strong narrative? And is that any different from us as journalists, for example?
So I think that Wout needs to see the rest of the series, and then he'll realise that it basically all sort of balances out and pays off, you know. And I think that what people don't understand, and there's absolutely no reason why they should understand, is that we can't tell every single aspect of every single story, every single beat in a kind of completely reflective manner, because they just, you know, you have to, by definition of, as you guys know, you have to basically witness something and then package it into a format which is basically 40 minutes long, okay? And it's a really, really difficult process, because you've got to basically make an episode work. If it doesn't work, then nobody's going to watch it, right? And so you have to basically bring together the elements in a way that is reflective of what happened, but in a narrative flow. And it's really hard getting that balance. And obviously, we want to basically be, you know, as you say, accurate and reflective of what went down as much as possible. But you're condensing, say, a week into 40 minutes. And you have to basically compress events into a shape that flows and goes from beginning to the end, as you know. And that it requires lots of choices. I think what people don't realize is that it's what you leave out, right, as opposed to what you include, that is basically the determining factor, because you have to leave out a ton of stuff because you can't put everything in, otherwise an episode would be weak, right? So you have to reduce it down to the fundamentals. And sometimes you have to take skips in order to get from A to B, well, actually from A to Z, quicker than you'd possibly like to. There's no more fundamental truth than the fact that it didn't work in the edit. And there's no reason why anyone should ever understand that, but it didn't work in the edit. And it's really annoying, because I'm the one near it going, it doesn't work, shit. So we've got to get it to work somehow.
It's always a big rivalry in cycling.
Tu peux être éliminé très très rapidement. Il faudra aller au-delà de la souffrance, au-delà de la douleur.
What about the aesthetic of the Tour de France? Because the Tour de France in European countries has quite a different demographic to the Tour de France in the UK and America, where the audience tends to be a bit younger, a bit cooler, sees the sport through a slightly different lens, whereas in France it's kind of the old person sport of summer. And we know anecdotally from a French colleague of ours that France Television really shies away from gritty images because it needs the tour to look clean and clear and vivid. It's a very primary coloured event, isn't it, the Tour de France? And as a filmmaker, I'm guessing, especially with your archive films, you know, you're never frightened of going towards the grainy, grittier truth. How did you find it working with kind of such, you know, vivid, bold, bright images?
Yeah,
and did you do anything to kind of, you know, change that to impose a slightly different aesthetic on it?
No, I think that's, I come back to my earlier point about basically looking at it from a really, really objective point of view and just trying to work out what it meant to me. You know, at the end of the day, I'm the one probably fundamentally who is signing up on various edits, right? And I'm the one that's going to, along with the team, obviously, and the rest of the gang, but sort of taking responsibility for it and trying to work out what I find compelling about it. Because, you know, that old adage is, you know, listen, if I don't want to watch it, then nobody's going to watch it. In my mind, I've got to make something that I think is worthy of, you know, somebody's time. And I think that, I know what you're saying in terms of, like, you know, the kind of viscerality and the texture of it all. But I didn't really find, I mean, I just found it endlessly kind of fascinating. It wasn't particularly hard for me to get engaged with it, because I was like, holy shit, the whole thing is kind of like utterly bonkers, and I can't spend enough time with it. So it's a bit like, you know, on Drive to Survive, Sky do a great job of their broadcast in terms of how they present Formula One, but we're not trying to replicate that at all. We're trying to do something entirely different for the audience, and I think the two things really coexist really well. But I obviously haven't seen the France Television coverage, so I couldn't tell you. So I just looked at it from an entertainment point of view. It's like, well, you know, what's cool about this, and what will people hopefully respond to? And that's, you know, you can't really do much more than that, because otherwise, if you're trying to second guess anybody, you're kind of dead in the water. You know, rightly or wrongly, I just go with my instincts and see where it takes me, and we basically drop it on the world, and sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. And there's, you know, that's kind of the sad reality of the situation.
James, you alluded to access earlier, and I suppose that this gets into maybe censorship as well by the teams. I mean, what were the rules of engagement, and how much of a difficult dance was that? And how does it compare? How is it compared to, for example, Formula One?
Well, it was pretty straightforward, actually. I mean, you know, it was fair. It was actually pretty painless, I've got to be honest. You know, maybe we were expecting more pushback or comment from the teams, but I think that actually everyone was fairly happy. I mean, I wasn't that directly involved in the review process, but I didn't get a sense of, oh my God, we've got to bin this edit and start all over again. It was pretty painless, and I think...
I mean, did they get a sort of approval, editorial approval? I mean, did they see the cuts, the teams? No.
Yeah. It seems, you know, in any of these shows, they all see it at some point before it goes out, but nobody gets editorial approval because there's only one person that gets that, and that's Mr. Netflix. So, you know, that's not me or anybody. So that's it's a collaborative exercise. There, you know, you don't really end up in situations where you have these massive standoffs. I mean, even on Drive to Survive, after all these years, you know, team principals will be like, oh my God, I really didn't want to say that. You caught me off guard. Can we have a chat about it? And you're like, yes, but, or okay, fine. You know, so common sense prevails. It's not really a thing, to be honest with you. If somebody genuinely shares something that is genuinely problematic, then we have a chat. But most of the time, it's all right.
James, there's a lot of talk that, I mean, you'll be aware, that there's this idea in cycling that cycling should be a lot bigger than it is. And this idea that there has been a glass ceiling and cycling is just waiting to burst through it. So there's kind of a lot of pressure on this series to do that, to help do that. And there's also a lot of talk about the Netflixification of sports and sports coverage. And I think that people define that in different ways. People have different ideas about what that means. Do you think that these, I mean, is it a hope of yours that these documentary series change or have any lasting impact on, well, either general sports broadcasting or even the very fabric of the sports themselves and the way the protagonists behave?
Listen, at the end of the day, the actual sport is the actual sport. And, you know, we've got no control over that at all. You know, our reflective interpretation is just one way of looking at it. And, you know, you can't have, you know, you have no input at all into the outcome. And it's ridiculous to think that we do in any way, shape or form. And when, you know, when people sort of accused us of having some input into that end of the Formula One season before last, you're like, what are you talking about? It's just like, of course we don't, you know, of course people aren't controlling the race outcome for Netflix's benefit. It's just like, you know, do you really, I mean, I'd love to be that powerful, it'd be great. But, you know, the sad truth is that I'm just another little tiny cog in the machine. So I'm a massive sport fan, and anything that basically brings more people to any of these sports, I don't know, is that a bad thing? I mean, I think that the reason why leagues are queuing up to make these shows is because there's a massive competition for eyeballs. And a lot of these sports are a bit male, pale and stale, and they need to get a younger demographic, right? And if we can help with that, I don't really see what the downside is. I mean, Formula One is unrecognizable from where it was 5 years ago, right? That is a bit of an outlier. I don't think that's going to happen with every single sport, because for some reason that's just radically changed. That was obviously what that sport kind of needed at that time. And it has been transformative, and it's pretty widely recognized as having some sort of impact. But, you know, and it's not just the show, but the show's got a large part to do with it. So everybody always has their own rationale and their own kind of justification for whatever happened. But I mean, I think you'd be hard pressed to not recognize that Formula One is watched by a much bigger, younger audience now than it was 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that's what they wanted, right? So job done. You know, I don't really know much about cycling, to be honest with you. So if people think that cycling should be bigger, then I hope that we can help it grow the audience, you know. Sometimes these shows do really make an impact, and sometimes they don't, you know. And I haven't got a magic wand. Nobody does. And, you know, it's just, you know, we do our best. We try to make something really entertaining. We love the sports we're dealing with. And if that's reflected in the experience, then great. I think that it's obviously definitely a moment whereby a lot of these shows are being made. People seem to be watching them. It seems to be what people want to see. Maybe people are kind of like, want to see less male serial killer tropes. Mm. Do you know what I mean? They want to, you know, sport is drama. That's the reason why I love it. It's because basically at the end of the day, sport is inherently dramatic. And it's you and me, you know. We can all sort of imagine what it's like to get on a bike or pick up a tennis racket or even maybe play rugby. I didn't really want to imagine what it's like to be a serial killer. It's not to really float my boat. So I think sport's kind of fairly authentic. It's pretty relatable on some level. And, you know, the audiences are pretty established. So we're just trying to, you know, rise all the tides.
James, I think we're going to lose you in a minute. But if you could just indulge us for a minute by maybe talking about a favourite scene or if not episode of the Unchained series or something that you saw when you saw it come in, you were really, really excited by.
I was telling your mate last night in the pub about the Pidcock beats and scenes and just what a lovely sort of breath of fresh air he is into the sport and his just kind of approach to just being a dive bomber and just kind of like, you know, think about how good those guys are at racing downhill and then you've got this guy coming along and just kind of like just totally BMXes it or whatever he does and just goes off the charts and just kind of like completely lawlessly kind of like rewrites the way that people, you know, do that stuff. And I think I love that. I think he's a great character. I mean, listen, there's so many great characters in it. And his approach to the sport is just so refreshing. And again, I say that as a novice, but I do like that kind of like, you know, let's just have fun with this and let's just bang down the mountain and just see what happens and just sort of like take everybody's breath away. So yeah, that's one of the things I loved about it. But there's many, many things I liked about it. I think Bout's a great character. I think Pagach is a great character, even though he's not even the show. I think his presence is really kind of like compelling. And actually, you know, we'd love to get the chance to do another series and to hopefully feature him because he's actually, even though he's the kind of, you know, the ruling power in the sport that has to be dethroned, he's got great energy and there's something really compelling about him. So, you know, yeah, there's lots of characters that I really like. So those guys, I think, I'll probably highlight.
Was there anything very odd or idiosyncratic? I mean, we also inhabit this strange, you know, pan-European, well, mainly it has been in the past, European sort of zoo. We're very much animals in that zoo where, you know, all these sports that have their own sort of patois. In cycling, it's this kind of pan-European patois, which is very heavily influenced by the Belgians and, you know, it has its own language, its own... Was there anything that you just... When you first watched, you thought these people behave very strangely in a particular fashion.
Well, pretty much all of them, all of the time. I think that it's it is a really, really profoundly strange but really compelling world. So no, I think it's listen. Like I said, I got my head around the fundamentals. I've got the basics of what is kind of going on. I'd love to now get more immersed in it and to kind of understand it more fully, but. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is a kind of learning curve, isn't it? And I think, you know, just seeing the difference between the two, you know, the kind of like sprinters and the climbers and just all the basics. It's just like, it's fascinating, the domestics and the team leaders or whatever it might be. So, no, I'm at page one and I've got to do more homework, but I am really keen to learn more because I think it really warrants it. And hopefully people will feel the same when they've watched the show.
Will there be a second series? If so, when? Will you be involved? And will you be watching the Tour de France this summer?
I'll definitely be watching. I'm actually going to try and go to a couple of stages. So we're talking to Netflix about season two. It hasn't been confirmed yet. So fingers crossed, we'll find out.
We're a cyclist. You always keep pushing and pedaling.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.